This is The Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Guerin-Flores, where we aim to give you bite-sized information regarding international arbitration topics of interest. Gaela and I are practitioners in the field of international arbitration, and we are both chairs of two committees of the DC Bar International Law Community. Today, we are back with you for part two of our damages series on The Tea with our rock star experts, Isabel Kunzman, Rebecca Velez, and Yelena Alexandrovich. So if you haven't listened to part one, go back, listen, and then come back to join us today for the conclusion to this episode. One of the main issues in undertaking forward-looking damage assessments is forecasting future events and quantifying risk. And I know we've touched upon this already a little bit, but in general, I think that they're both areas where big data and AI can be used to determine the range of possible outcomes in a more robust way. And in particular, I have heard about the Monte Carlo simulation and also the Latin hypercube approach. So what are these things? Are they still used? And or do you prefer to rely instead on a different approach, even if it might not have as cool of a name?
So the Monte Carlo simulation is used to measure the profitability of different outcomes due to various random variables. So multiple values are assigned to different variables, such as the sales volumes or prices or costs, tax rates, interest rates, any factors that go into models. You can assign different values to it and then run the Monte Carlo simulation, which runs the entire model with each iteration of these variables. And then the results are averaged to come to a final result. So this is still used. I've seen it in a small number of my cases. Other experts actually call it the modified DCF when it's specifically used with a DCF model. In my opinion, the downfall of Monte Carlo is that it can become very cumbersome because the range of variables can become very extreme, and then it can make the model difficult to work with. For example, in one of my cases, this was maybe a year and a half ago, the claimant's expert put forth a modified DCF using Monte Carlo, and we tried to work with his model, and it would run on our computer for hours and hours, and then it would just crash, and we were never able to get their results. So I personally don't use it and don't love the Monte Carlo simulation. The Latin hypercube is a process that's used to generate samples, and it creates inputs into the Monte Carlo. The purpose of it is to reduce the processing time because it sets certain limitations where it limits the number of variables. So in the instance that I just mentioned, apparently they didn't use the Latin hypercube because it just kept going and going. So I've never used the Latin hypercube either because I don't use Monte Carlo. I prefer to identify the variables that I feel make the largest impact on the analysis that I'm working on. And then I'll run a sensitivity analysis, which is basically a not so cool version of Monte Carlo because you do it more manually and the variables are a lot more limited. So I'll change two or three variables within a DCF model, and then I present the client and the tribunal in the end. I'll present a table that just lists the variables that I've changed and what the impacts to the models are.
Rebecca, when you say you change certain variables manually, what does that mean in your world? Because to me as a lawyer, Excel and a lot of what you do, there's virtually nothing manual about it. Do you mean you're going into an Excel spreadsheet and picking out a variable and testing to see if that value or if that actual variable is something that you believe is accurate? And if it's not, you literally just change it?
So typically when I prepare a DCF model, I will have a one tab within Excel, which is like the main inputs to the model. So for example, like sales, we'll assign a growth rate to sales. And if I have it set at like 5% year over year growth, and the model pertains to something that's very dependent on sales, then I'll say, well, what would happen if I change that growth rate to 7% instead of 5%? So I'll just go into the input tab and just change where I previously had 5%, I would change that to 7%. And then I'd have a results tab that then shows me what the results are with the 7%. You can do it. I mean, you can set it up like that with any of the variables. Like the WAC is one that we play with a lot too, because it has so many different components.
And the WAC for our listeners is
the weighted average cost of capital. So it takes into consideration the company's cost of equity and cost of debt, the company's capital structure, and comes up with an average of those costs. And that the WAC is applied to the future cash flows that are developed in the DCF model to bring it to a present value as of the valuation date.
Thanks, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
So I've had a very similar experience as Rebecca with the Monte Carlo simulation. I've seen it used in some cases, but I've never used it myself. And the reason why is because I haven't come across an investment yet where the hypothetical buyers and sellers typical of that market use it. So if I find if I had to value an investment where the buyers and sellers did use the Monte Carlo simulation, then I would use it. But otherwise, I wouldn't. So for example, if I'm valuing options, I will apply a Black-Scholes model, and I would even go deeper into figuring out if the typical buyers and sellers of that market use the Black-Scholes 76 or a binomial model. So the bottom line is that the standard of value and the context in which it is being used will determine the specific valuation methodology that I will use. And that is because under the fair market value standard, the market can be thought of as all of the hypothetical buyers and sellers typical of the item being valued. So even if I disagree with the method or the model that the buyers and sellers of that market use, I still have to use that method because it is what they use to come up with the value of those assets in that market.
So in that case, you would use that method, and then would you sort of counter with your own method that you believe to be more appropriate?
No, because if I did that, I would be relying on intrinsic value, right, and not fair market value. And of course, this is all assuming that I'm applying fair market value. So I am placing myself in the shoes of the potential buyers and sellers of that market, not in my personal opinion of how the typical buyers and sellers of that market should value that asset. Because in the end, whoever claimant is wouldn't be selling their investment to me. They would be selling the investment to the hypothetical buyers of that investment in that market.
Yelena?
Sure. So at the risk of repeating anything that Rebecca and Isabel just said, similarly, I don't typically apply the Monte Carlo simulation or the Latin hypercube, but I don't disagree with it in concept. Generally, it can be particularly useful for like an early stage investment where there is potentially a bigger range of inputs, as Rebecca was explaining earlier, that could be used in the model. It's also more transparent in the range of values that can be applied than a traditional DCF. But similar to Rebecca's experience, in practice, it is really cumbersome. So it can lead to crashing computers, difficulty in understanding how the model works itself, because it's not as easy to understand as just a traditional DCF, where you look at one line item and you see, okay, I used a 5% sales growth assumption, just going off of Rebecca's example. it is, I think, easier to see a sensitivity table rather than an average of who knows how many randomly generated variables that would go into the input of the model. But in concept, I don't think that it's an inappropriate model to apply.
It sounds like it might, Monte Carlo might, there might be a bit more potential for abuse. Like, it sounds like it's not quite as transparent, or you could make it not as transparent in a Monte Carlo situation or scenario, or I'm not exactly sure what it's called, approach. It sounds like you could kind of it might be easier to hide the different variables that you're actually considering to come up with an average. Whereas if you go into your model manually and you disclose very specifically where you're changing certain values due to certain sensitivity tests, it seems like it forces you to be a bit more transparent in your approach. But maybe, I don't know, that's just the sense that I got when you were explaining things, but maybe not.
It's kind of both, I would say. It's more transparent in that it shows you the entire range of values, but it is a bunch of values, like almost an unlimited amount, depending on the limitations that you set on it that go into it, rather than in the example that you gave, you could make it more specific to the case. Whereas you could say, okay, likely it's the range is going to be between 5% and 7%, let's say in the sales growth assumptions. So I can limit the output to be based off of those specific variables. But in a Monte Carlo, again, you can set your parameters, but it could take anywhere from the 5 to 5.1 to whatever, 5.2, just unlimited variations of it. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's less transparent. It could be if you don't explain it correctly, but
I think that's the key, is the explaining it, because with a Monte Carlo on its own, it would be very difficult to tell exactly what is causing the different results. Whereas with a sensitivity analysis and a sensitivity table as the result, you can specifically pinpoint what variable was changed in the model and how that impacted your result.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure the three of you know I'm all about transparency when it comes to dampness, for sure. Now, with that discussion, I thought it quite appropriate to give you a slightly provocative question. And that is, if you had the chance, what would you say to the makers of the 1992 Teen Talk Barbie, who very famously said, "Math class is tough"? Yelena, do you have an opinion on the 1992 Teen Talk Barbie's statements about math?
I definitely disagree with that. I don't think that math is tough. I think it's actually fun, but that's probably why I'm a damages expert and not in a different line of work. I think just like anything else, it's if you understand the process and the steps of how to do something, it kind of becomes second nature. And that's also why I'm really thankful that you have this podcast and the platform to be able to allow listeners to understand what it is that we do. And not only listeners that are already in this field, but young people. I know that when I was in high school, college, and definitely younger, I had no idea what international arbitration was. So it is really exciting to have this platform to, one, share what international arbitration is, two, share what it is that we do, and also to make it be well known that it shouldn't be an intimidating thing to be in a field that requires you to have math knowledge. It's actually something that, you know, with practice, you can really excel at, just like anything else in life. And what's hard about our job is not the application of the damages concepts or the math. It's the data and finding the right assumptions that you are able to defend when you are putting together that math into a model.
Thanks, Yelena. Rebecca?
Well, I was never really a Barbie girl, so I'm not very familiar with this 1992 Teen Talk Barbie, but it seems like it's a doll that had like certain phrases that it would speak to, presumably the girls that were playing with the with Barbies. Now, and this is something that I like encourage with my two daughters as well. They know I do a lot of math. I really encourage them to do math. And thankfully, they seem to enjoy it. So back to what I would say to the makers of this doll is like, you know, math, I think it can be tough sometimes. But I think the fact that it's tough is what makes it fun, because then you work at it and you overcome it. And it gives you a sense of pride, especially as a little girl. So I would absolutely not let them get to me. And I would just say, you know what? Yeah, math can be tough, but watch me excel at it and watch my young girls excel at it too.
Yeah, no, I definitely as someone who was a little girl myself point, but also a mom of two young girls. I can definitely echo that. That sentiment. And Isabel, I know you would have something to say to the makers of the Teen Talk Barbie of 1992.
I would. And here I'm putting on my strategy consultant hat on. So my answer to the makers would be that failure to address unconscious gender bias can result in very expensive mistakes and long-term negative effects on a company's bottom line. So putting aside that gender equality is a moral imperative, companies should view achieving gender equality as a business imperative if they want to survive in the long term. Therefore, they should invest the time, money, and effort to achieve it commensurate with its critical importance.
And there you have it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's hard to get better answers than those three.
From an expert. I hope everyone is really, really listening to that point.
All had very different answers, but all very true and on point, in my opinion.
And now maybe we won't like your answers quite as much, but our next question to you is, if there were one thing, just one, you could change about international arbitration lawyers, what would it be? Isabel, I'm going to start with you on this one.
I would tell lawyers that they must address the lack of gender diversity in the selection process of quantum experts. It is critical.
Elena?
Sure. So one thing I would say is in the interest of efficiency, to limit line editing a preliminary draft. There have been numerous instances, and I'm sure Rebecca and Isabel can relate to this, when we're sending out a preliminary draft or something that is still weeks away from being the final. And then we're continuing to work on it, or I'm continuing to work on it in the background, and then receive a bunch of line edits from the legal team, which I'm sure is with the best of intentions, but we've already changed the text. So it just creates more work for us and really just kind of inefficient, especially in those last couple of weeks when you're trying to finalize everything.
To add to that, the worst is when lawyers are editing their previous edits, which happens more than you would think it should.
We never, ever do that. Isabel, how could you possibly say that?
Never.
Rebecca, do you have a gripe you want to share?
Yes, I do. I agree with both Isabel's and Yelena's. To Isabel's point, I actually have an experience when there's one time an attorney flat out said to me, and I was not the expert on this case. I was supporting the expert, but I was the one at the meeting with the client, and the attorney said to me, I know that you're the one doing the work, but I need a male or someone with white hair or no hair to be the expert. And I was just appalled. So that's kind of a side story. To answer your question about the one thing I would change, along the lines of what Yelena said with editing preliminary drafts, to me, it's more bothersome when I receive edits last minute, like right before the report is going to be filed. And it comes from multiple attorneys, not just one. So then they each have their own style and they try to just change grammar or just stylistic things in the report, which do not make a difference in the opinion. And yet they want me to spend hours transferring commas over to my report. So I would like to change that and have the attorneys accept that the report is the expert's report, not their report.
All very, very reasonable comments, sounds like to me. Even though we might not like to hear it, I think it's important that we do. But particularly the gender diversity comment, that is a part of our field that, it's an absolute stain on our field, and there's no excuse for it. You know, we have here on this podcast three absolutely brilliant and stellar damages experts at the top of your game, and I don't think I need to look at any studies to know that you all are probably appointed with less frequency than male colleagues. And that's really inexcusable. And it's something that our field really needs to work on. Unfortunately, it's not limited to damages experts, but I think it's really heightened in, you know, that whole phenomenon is just so heightened in the damages experts field. I know that one consulting firm recently sent me a survey to ask just how many women damages experts were involved in the cases that I had worked on. And the answers to that were they weren't reassuring. And, you know, frankly, extremely disappointing and demoralizing.
I would say just that, you know, while at least I don't know about you, Gayla, I don't know that I can promise that I won't line edit a damages expert report going forward. Maybe not the first draft anymore, but for sure, I think at least Gayla and I are very committed to correcting the gender disparity, whether in damages experts or otherwise in our field.
No, I think we would probably all agree with one of RBG's comments about the Supreme Court. Someone asked her if she would be happy, you know, when would she possibly be happy when, you know, 50% of the justices were women? And she responded, when we're all women and it's not even a thing, you know, no one comments about it. So wouldn't it be great if no one were to comment on this podcast and say, whoa, it was all women talking about international arbitration and damages in international arbitration. That's when I'll be happy, when it's a non-event. That would be a wonderful thing. So with that, I think our last question, what's typically our last question is, other than the things that we've already discussed, some of them I'm sure do keep you up at night, but other than the things that we've already discussed, what things, whether they're damages related or not, are keeping you up at night these days? Isabel?
I would say that I wish there were damages concepts keeping me up at night these days instead of the awful events that we're living through these days. Hopefully in the near future, I will go back to worrying about damages concepts in the middle of the night. And I suspect that one issue that will be keeping me up at night is the potential that arbitrators will view the pandemic as a black swan event that will have negative implications on all valuations, regardless of the industry or the particular company. In fact, the impact of the pandemic has been very uneven across industries and even within the same industry. So the pandemic has been positive for some companies and neutral for others. So as I mentioned before, too, you also have the issue that the fair market valuation would not account for a typical market inefficiencies or irrational market exuberance or pessimism. which might be what is happening right now on some current valuations. So as a hypothetical seller of an asset, you wouldn't sell your investment or asset right in the middle of a pandemic if the pandemic has had an extraordinary negative effect on your industry or company.
Actually, that's a really interesting point, Isabel, with the effect of the pandemic. That definitely is going to be something that we're all going to have to consider for current valuations and for ex-ante ones in, you know, a few years. So for sure, that's definitely going to be an interesting concept. I think another one, and I've kind of already touched on this, and it's not necessarily a damages concept, but just experts' lack of or seeming lack of independence. That gives me pause at night when I receive another report and I have to respond to it. And it's so clear that they're just advocating or basing something off of witness testimony and not doing the work that it takes to ensure the accuracy of their report or the reasonableness of whatever they're relying on, whether that be witness testimony or another valuation that might have been done previously. We still have to do the due diligence in order to ensure that the report that we are putting out or the report that the opposing expert is putting out is accurate. And I think potentially one of the ways that we'll solve that problem is touching on another point we said earlier in the podcast. It's having more diversity in experts. It's having some new blood in the industry, having more women, having younger people, just people who are going to do things a little bit different and not necessarily the way that it's always been done. And actually being, not that other people have not been credible, but, you know, like sticking to your guts when you think that something is right and standing up for the right thing and actually trying to help the tribunal and your client in a genuine way, in a way with integrity.
Thanks, Yelena. And Rebecca, what's keeping you up at night these days?
There are a few things keeping me up these days. I mean, definitely we're all living it, right? The pandemic is just on everyone's mind all the time and what impact that's going to have personally, professionally, like socially, just in every aspect. But as far as work-related or damages-related, interest rates recently have just become a hot topic for me. I feel like my most recent cases, a big portion of their damages are based on interest that's been applied to the damage number that was calculated by the opposing side. And in the past, to be honest, I've felt like interest was mainly left to the tribunal. Like we would say in, you know, earlier versions of or earlier cases that I worked on, we would simply say, oh, you know, we recommend a compound rate that would be fair and bring them back to, you know, the position that they would be in if the alleged breach didn't occur, and just leave it at that, and, you know, or say it's up to the tribunal. Whereas now I feel like we need to put a lot more effort into the interest rate recommendation that we put forward. So that's just kind of a new hot topic for me. And like I said, like specifically my last like three cases, very, very high percentage of the damages are based on the interest rate. So I really need to think about that now.
Is that because market forces have changed, or it's just a different hot topic in arbitration? What do you think is driving that?
I mean, I think it might be a little bit of both. Like the market forces, they have changed, but then, you know, in my one of my cases, I know that the number that they came up with was very low. And it was like 20 years ago, and now they want damages as of today. So to make the number good for them, they just tacked on a lot of interest. And I feel like it's incorrect, but I need to make a strong case for that, because they just decided to apply a bond rate, which I just don't think is applicable in that case. I mean, in some cases it might be. I definitely think about it a lot more nowadays.
I think that it's, sorry to jump in, Rebecca, but I think it's also coming up more now with the phasing out of LIBOR. So it's coming up in more cases that I've seen as well, where people are scrambling to figure out, well, what's the right interest rate to apply, because everyone's so used to using LIBOR plus 2 or plus 4 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there are other rates that we now have to consider, which, to be frank, I've always included in reports other alternative rates, but LIBOR is a big one.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because within my team at Credibility, we put together a study of all of the public available awards, mm-hmm. Damages awards out there. And one of the aspects that we analyze is the interest rate that was put forth by both claimant and respondent and ultimately awarded by the tribunal. And we have an edition of the study coming out later this month. So I hope you all get to see it. There's a pun for it here on the podcast. But the most common interest rate has been awarded been LIBOR plus 2 or LIBOR plus 4.
Yep. This must be a hot thing to do because we do the exact same thing. And that has been the conclusion as well. That's why it's so interesting to see what's going to be happening in the next few years of what tribunals are applying now that LIBOR is no longer going to be the rate.
It's also going to be an issue too for those awards that are caught in the middle, right? That they are still open and that LIBOR interest rate should be applied, but then LIBOR disappears, then I don't know if ICSID is going to need to step in or the ICC, because that could reopen cases that have already been closed. Someone needs to address that.
Well, thank you so much, all three of you, for being here with us today. I, for one, always find it super helpful and extremely edifying anytime I speak with you. You know, you have definitely spent so much time just educating me on the various concepts that go behind great damages analyses. And I thank you for that.
Indeed. Thank you to all of our illuminating guests today. Isabel Kunzman, Rebecca Velez, and Yelena Aleksandrovich. And thank you to the DC Bar. To check out more of what DC Bar communities have to offer, please visit dcbar.org/communities. You have been listening to The Tea on International Arbitration. Watch out for new episodes. And if you like this episode, please tell a friend about it and subscribe at anchor.fm/dcbartea or anywhere else you access your podcast.